Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of May. I think we live up to our name of the Ideas Network when we have guests like Howard Gardner with us. I'm so happy to say Howard Gardner is our guest the next hour of the program. He's a great thinker. He, in the May-June issue of Foreign Policy, responds to the question, what is the next big thing? And his response is personalized education. A quantum leap in learning, he writes, will allow everyone to go to the head of the class. Through most of history, only the wealthy have been able to afford an education geared to the individual learner. For the rest of us, education is more or less a mass affair. Professor Howard Gardner is the John H. and Elizabeth A. Hobbs Professor of Cognition and Education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He received a MacArthur Prize Fellowship in 1981. He has received honorary degrees from 22 colleges and universities all over the world, Chile, Ireland, Israel, and Italy. He was named in 2004 an honorary professor at East China Normal University in Shanghai. He was selected by Foreign Policy and Prospect magazines as one of the 100 most influential public intellectuals in the world. He's written 20 books. They've been translated into 27 different languages. He's also, for over 10 years now, done a great deal of work on the Good Work Project, which we'll talk to him about in addition to individualized learning. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you want to send us an email, you can do that as well. It's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Howard Gardner, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen, and for that overly generous introduction, which I appreciated very much.
You have a big life. What am I to say? You really do. You have a big life. You were speaking somewhere last week. Maybe it was in California. And I love this comment that you were talking about. Maybe at some point we'll walk into our classrooms and say, hey, I got a brain chip in my head. This is how I need to be taught. Do you think we're going to do that?
Well, both in neuroscience, study of the brain, and in genetics, we've amassed more knowledge in the past few decades than in all of human history. And if you said to me, Howard, you know, today, should we do anything different in classes as a result of what we know about the brain and genetics, I would say, well, maybe in the area of reading, but otherwise, no. Nonetheless, to me, it's inconceivable that all of that information that we're gathering isn't going to have educational potential. And so the perhaps somewhat caricature picture that I've drawn is some years from now, a young child, or more likely his or her parent, walks into school and says, you know, here's the functional MRI. Here's the gene chip. This is what's special about Johnny or Sally's brain. This is what's special about the genome. We don't want him or her to be taught like everybody else. We want them to be taught in ways in which they can learn, in which they can show what they're learning. And at Harvard, we've actually started a whole field called Mind, Brain, and Education. And one of the things I say when talking to students is that if educators don't know how to make sense of this neurological and genetic information, then education will become a medical subspecialty. Now, that's not a value judgment. Maybe it ought to. But my goal is to motivate people involved in education to know, for example, if two people say, well, this is brain-based education, do they know what they're talking about and do they draw the same conclusions therefrom?
Mm-hmm. You talk about, and I'm wondering what is the history of this, the fact that we insist on teaching all students the same subjects in the same way, and as long as we do that, our progress in terms of becoming smarter and better people will be incremental. Why do we do that? Is it cheaper to study to teach people this way? Are we teaching for a reason to mold people in a certain way? What is it?
I think there are a couple of separate reasons, and you've touched on them. One is it certainly seems less expensive and more efficient to present everything in the same way, teach everybody the same subject in the same way, and assess them in the same way. The other thing, though, until recently, it has seemed fair because it seems like we're treating everybody the same way, which sounds, you know, on the face of it, like a fair procedure. And this is where my own work over the decades has been disruptive, so to speak. I claim that all of us have a number of different intelligences, and some of these are particularly tied into the way that we do school nowadays. And because the way we do school is a political kind of decision, my argument is that school has always been cast toward individuals who have what I call the language logic blend, or more familiarly, the law school professor blend. If you're good in language and logic, you will do well in school, on school tests, on IQ tests and SATs. And as long as you stay in school, you'll be smart. And since these tests are all made up by people who are lifelong schoolers, as I am, then you're just like looking in the mirror. You say, isn't that great? If, however, Kathleen, we all have different profiles of intelligence. Some people are stronger in spatial intelligence. Some people are stronger in bodily kinesthetic intelligence. Some people are stronger in interpersonal or naturalist intelligence, to mention some of the non-language logic blend. Then we're actually doing something that's very unfair. We're saying, look, you don't happen to have strength in language and logic, and so we're going to consider you to be marginal, and you know, maybe we'll put you through school for a while, but if you can't make it, too bad. And until perhaps the middle of the 20th century, this was okay, because most people first had agricultural jobs and then they had factory jobs, and there you didn't really have to have an education which went that far. But nowadays, everything that can be done by computers or by some kind of a machine will be. And so there's a tremendous premium all over the world in educating everybody. And we can't just say, well, you know, Johnny, you haven't got the language logic combination, so too bad. Go elsewhere. We have to try to figure out how, I won't say everybody, but how the vast majority of people can learn languages, can learn mathematics, can learn about the arts, can learn about philosophy. And if we try to do this one size fits all, we're going to fail with most people. So that's really, if I can be a little bit pretentious, that's kind of a Copernican revolution. Rather than using education as a filtering system to filter out the non-future law professors, instead you say it's not the child that's failed, it's the educational system has failed because we haven't come up with curricula and pedagogy, et cetera, which takes every child to the maximum. I'm not one of these people who says every child is an Einstein, and I don't even remember saying every child is first in the class. That sounds like what some editor said. But I certainly would argue that kids who don't happen to have that language-logic blend shouldn't be cast aside, and maybe we'll be pleasantly surprised about how well they could do. Now, I also point out in that foreign policy article that there's one group that's always got personalized education, and that's the very wealthy, because the very wealthy hire tutors. And you can't say to the tutor, well, Prince Charles couldn't learn, give me Princess Anne instead. Your job is to get Prince Charles or whoever to learn no matter what. And tutors, whether they're tutoring in music or in fencing or in algebra, have to be innovative and say, well, this hasn't worked. Let's try something else. Now, I'm hardly a leading technophile. I have lots of issues about technology. And yet anybody who spends, any number of minutes a week on all kinds of websites, whether they're news websites or book purchasing websites or consumer websites or Craigslist kind of websites, know that the technology has incredible ability to personalize.
Yes.
I have a Kindle. And last night I'm going on a bunch of trips, so I decided to to order some books. And I love bookstores because you can go there and kind of browse. And, of course, on the Kindle, you ought to know what you want. But I noticed they were recommending 25 books. And sure enough, they mentioned several books that I'd never heard of, but ones they were right. Those are ones that I want to read based on my previous reading.
Yes,
and
yes.
I could even make the inference about how they figured out which books. The funniest thing, Kathleen, was number 6 was my wife's book, Alan Winter's Gifted Children.
Well,
I didn't bother to order that one.
That's absolutely wonderful. Yeah, I like it because of the friends. First, I've connected with people. But I love these groups that the people you respect, the people whose minds you want to know what they're reading and what groups they've joined. It's just opened up a lot of things to me. And I read pretty widely, but I'm kind of enjoying it. I never thought I would, but I am kind of enjoying it these days.
And you can see anybody,
along.
Right. Anybody who lives in a world like this is sooner or later going to say, gee, it's nuts that we sit down on a bolted desk and there's one teacher and 25 or 40 kids and we're all on the same page of the same book. That's not how any other part of my life is being led. And Clay Christensen, a colleague who's been very influential in business circles, has this notion of disruptive technologies, namely that it's the people who think everything is going the best, so to speak, the General Motors of 50 years ago, who miss out on the stuff that's being developed on the periphery, which actually allows many more people to do things much less expensively and sometimes more efficiently. And he hypothesizes, we don't know whether this is right or not, but he hypothesizes that the disruptive in technologies and education will not occur in the mainstream, namely in teaching American history or teaching geometry, but rather in things which are somewhat more peripheral, let's say teaching musical composition or chess or something about social networking. And when people discover that using the technology, you can learn things tremendously more efficiently and more in more personalized fashion for the reasons we've been just talking about, then they're going to begin to pressure the schools to say, you know, throw out this one-size-fits-all, throw out this one textbook stuff. Johnny learns better through doing hands-on materials. Sally likes to manipulate virtual reality. Billy is a social network kind of person. As we all know, the media have vast multimedia potentials. And so, you know, some people learn from artistic things. Some people learn from narrative things. Some people learn from, you know, logical equations, from games. Games are huge. Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin at Madison has actually been a center of games for education. And so when foreign policy, you know, said, what's the new big thing? I don't know what the new big thing is going to be in computer chips. I don't know what the new big thing is going to be in ecology or in the Middle East. But in education, I just can't conceive that 10 or 20 years from now, we're still going to be using this standardized one-size-fits-all approach. If we are, I think I say this in the article, it's those countries, and I usually bet on Singapore or Finland because they're usually ahead of the game, the ones who figure out how to personalize much more, they're going to have an open playground for their young people and for their not so young, because everybody listening to the show knows you can't anymore go to high school and maybe even college and say, well, I'm 21 years old. My education has ceased. Those of us who don't continue lifelong learning are very quickly pushed to the side.
Right. So give me a better idea. When you say that we already have the technology to do this personalized education, we have well-programmed computers. Give me a better sense, Howard, of how we personalize education using computers. And do we go beyond computers? Do we use more teachers in a classroom to be able to give this instruction?
Well, I think the role of teacher is going to change fundamentally, and the metaphor is really the teacher as coach. Mm. Just to use as an example, because it'll be familiar to most listeners, if you went to college many years ago, as I did, you know, you were kind of at the mercy of whoever the lecturer happened to be, who was sometimes wonderful, sometimes mediocre, and all too often soporific, is that the word I want, putting us to sleep?
That's a good word.
Right. I mean, nowadays, you know, you can iTunes University or the TED conference, you can hear the greatest lecturers in the world not just talk but give multimedia presentations. So it's kind of ridiculous for me as a vanilla ice cream professor to try to give the same lecture. Instead, you know, I can say to my students either orally or through the internet, you know, if you want to know about, you know, the Spanish-American War, here's 10 great resources to look at, and here's the world's expert on it talking about it, and here's a game that you can play about it, et cetera, et cetera. So you see what I mean by coach. It's somebody who kind of knows all the tools that are around, and the good coach knows you as well. There's no point in having a human coach if the recommendation is the same for everybody. In fact, the best coaches will be one step ahead of the technology. Kindle was pretty good at telling me what books I'd want to read, but I bet you my students would do a better job because they have a more of a 360-degree view of me. Nonetheless, you got to keep on your toes to keep ahead of Amazon or Google, because they are very shrewd at inventing algorithms which eventually may get you to know yourself better than other human beings, even those who know you. I mean, many people point out, and I'm sympathetic to this, that in the past, a lot of education was accidental. You know, you'd go to the bookstore or the library looking for one thing, and then peripherally you'd see something else. Of course, there's nothing to prevent technology from doing that as well. You know, there's a periphery on the computer screen, just as there is in a library or in an independent bookstore. But the other thing I have in mind is this, Kathleen, and I can't say that I know of this firsthand, though I've been writing about it for a while, and this summer a student and I are going to look at it more carefully. Let's take a topic which we expect everybody to learn, like algebra. I know firsthand there are many ways to teach algebra. In fact, Robert Moses, who's a very innovative teacher in Boston 15 years ago, invented a way of teaching it via stops on our subway, on our T, as it's called in Boston, and, you know, learning about missing places and filling them in and so on. The educational institution, which could be Google U, I'm making that up, or it could be MIT, or, you know, it could be Walmart's, that assembles all these different ways of teaching algebra, lets you try them out, doing the one that works the best for you, remembering that computers are infinitely patient. So, you know, when I tutored my kids, I got impatient when they didn't catch something right away. The computer doesn't get impatient. Not only can present you with that ensemble of options, but what's best of all, and here, as we talked earlier, computers will be competing with human beings, will say, well, this way of learning this lesson in algebra worked best for you. When we go on to this somewhat different lesson in algebra, or we're moving into trigonometry now, we're moving into statistics, what do we know about how you learned, what you liked to do, what you did well at, what problems attracted you, can we make use of in the next platform? And, I would be delighted if some people, you know, a third of my age or half my age are listening on the radio and saying, you know, that's right, and I'm going to try to, you know, put together some of these materials for it. So when I say, I can't say to you yet and to your listeners, Kathleen, this is the website that's figured out how to do it about chess or how to do it about fencing or how to do it about, the history of the of ships navigating on the Mediterranean. But I'd be very surprised if some years from now that option isn't available. And we may have listeners who call up and say, listen, this is go to such and such website. I found it the best way to, let's say, learning about the financial meltdown.
Right.
I used to be one of these people who spend a minute with the business section and then tossed it aside for stuff I thought was more interesting. That changed irrevocably, yes, probably in September of 2008 when Lehman Brothers melted down, and within weeks the whole world was in financial turmoil. For me, it's been a matter of self-education to figure out how to learn more. But if somebody knew exactly how I learned, they could have said, Howard, this is the media site to go to. These use the right metaphors, analogies, pictures, diagrams, equations, you name it. I would have hopped right to it.
Right. Howard Gardner is our guest. We're going to welcome phone calls for him. He, of course, has written 20 books, best known for Multiple Intelligences, and you can hear him weave it into the conversation we've had so far. We are drawn to his thoughts about everything, but if you want to pay attention to some of his current thoughts, the May-June issue of Foreign Policy looks at the question, the next big thing, what is the next big thing? And they ask some of the world's great thinkers the answer, and he writes a very interesting piece about personalized education. Our lines are all filled, but there will be an opening sooner or later. Our number is 800-486-8655. We have some emails coming in as well, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Howard Gardner is our guest this hour, and let's go to phone calls. We start with Judith from St. Germain. Hi, Judith.
Hello.
Hello, Judith.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to let the professor know that with his pursuits, if he needs a brain to study. Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay. I don't know if you heard me before, but I said with the professor's pursuits, if he needs a brain to study, I'd love to let him pick mine. It's all my life, and I'm in my...
Are you there, Judith?
Yeah.
Go right ahead. We can hear you fine.
Oh, okay. I guess I'm listening to the radio, too, and I thought...
Oh, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
Okay. I've been having problems learning all my life, and I'm in my mid-50s now, and I'm not ready to, let things up. Let things go, so...
How well, I think Judith puts her finger on where the... I think the meeting of brain science and education will occur first. If somebody is doing fine in school, not having learning problems, I think I always say give a prayer of thanks and just keep going. But if you have a person of any age who's having learning problems, that's where both psychology, that is, knowing how you're doing on certain kinds of tests and clinical investigations, and increasingly neuroscience, knowing not so much the anatomy of your brain, but rather how it functions when you're doing some kind of a problem solving. I think that's where the first meeting of neuroscience and education will take place. And remember at the very beginning of the talk, I said that I thought that this is probably – we're just about there in the area of reading. As most listeners know, somewhere between 5% and 15% of the population has an unexpected difficulty learning to read a Western language, even though the people are learning perfectly well otherwise, and we call that dyslexia. And we now know a lot about the early detection of dyslexia, and we know a lot about the different patterns of recovery. And there, I really think the joining of hands of people who know the neurological material and people who know the educational material is at hand. I'm not going to present myself as somebody who, even if I spent some time with Judith looking at an image of her brain or giving her a lot of tests, that I'd know exactly what to do. But speaking quite seriously, there are people called clinical neuropsychologists who combine that brain understanding and that clinical understanding, and they might well be able to make some useful suggestions. I wanted to point out, too, something which was just implicit in our earlier conversation. I used the examples of learning algebra, but also the examples of figuring out what's going on with financial meltdown. And those were important examples because algebra is something that we think as a society people need to understand. So to speak, that's on the international curriculum, rightly or wrongly. There's no requirement that you learn about the financial meltdown. It's just if you're curious about what's happening, you're going to want to do that. And the important point to make explicit is under the new educational dispensation, let's call it that, not only will you be able to learn better those things which the world thinks you need to know, but you'll also be able to learn things that you want to know, whether or not anybody knows or cares. And that's the wonderful thing about the Internet is you can explore just about anything and do it in your own way. There's been a very important observation recently. One of the truisms in the area of cognitive studies, it takes about 10 years to be a genuine expert on something. And this has been documented with things like chess and musical composition. I mentioned those two areas earlier. It now appears that 10 years has actually been halved. Believe it or not, kids are showing up as experts in playing chess, grandmaster level, and as experts in musical composition, stuff that's really pretty good, after about 5 years, not 10 years. Now, I can assure you the genes have not changed. And there's nothing about our brain per se that has changed. What's changed is we now have software that is so finely attuned to where the learner is at and can always present something that's just a little bit more of a stretch. It's easy to see in chess than in music, but it's the same idea that what used to happen with well-motivated people but not having as clear a pathway of what it takes to be a novice, an apprentice, and a master has now been worked out with quite exquisite detail. And since we all feel overwhelmed about all the things we have to learn and all the things that we want to learn, it's very exciting that software has made it possible, at least for motivated people, to learn things more quickly. Now, whether that 10 years can be pushed down to 3 or 4 years, nobody knows. But it's a bit like breaking the mile. Until the 1950s, nobody ran the mile under 4 minutes. But once Roger Bannister ran the mile under 4 minutes, which I think was in the 50s or maybe early 60s, now that's routine. So once you have chess masters or kids whose music is being performed after just several years rather than a decade, then it becomes much easier for other people because they say, well, if he or she can do it, so can I.
In one of your new books, Five Minds for the Future, you talk about mastery of major schools of thought, Howard, including science, math, and history, and at least one professional craft. Is there basic knowledge that we all need to know about how the economy works, about geometry and algebra, about, you know, great American writers in the 20th century that we could teach those people, which is all of us? First of all, is there a curriculum that we need to all know about, and can we do that on a mass level, or can we dispense with certain kinds of subjects that we don't care anything about?
That's a very big and long and deep question. I am not one of those people who goes along with E.D. Hirsch, who is a well-known and respected educational thinker who talks about cultural literacy. And he talks about the thousands of names, facts, dates that he thinks everybody needs to know, because we need to have people who share the same knowledge base. The major reason that I don't agree with this is because I have in my hand, and many people who are listening will have in their hand as well, a little apparatus where all that information is contained. And the ability to access that in your personal assistant means that you're relieved of the necessity of taking up valuable time to store it inside your mind brain. Also, anytime you give me 5,000, I'll give you another 5,000, which I think are every bit as important. And so it's you're never going to be able to satisfy everybody. Therefore, when I talk about the disciplined mind in that book, Five Minds for the Future, I'm actually talking about scientific, mathematical, historical, and artistic ways of thinking. And again, that's a big topic. But to think scientifically is to think very different than to think historically. Very briefly, scientists make models of the world, and they test those models through observation and experiments. That's what physicists do. That's what psychologists do. That's what geologists do, et cetera. Historians try to figure out what went on in the past. We weren't there. So you have to assemble it from print, or in the last century or so, from graphic information. People who lived in the past are very different from us, but they're also human beings. So there's a very delicate kind of triangulation of figuring out in which way did people who lived in Greece 3,000 years ago or people who lived in England 150 years ago were different, and in which ways are they just like us. Finally, every generation has to rewrite history, because you can't leave yourself out. If you wrote the history of the Roman Empire today, it would be entirely different than if you wrote it 100 years ago, because today the United States is the Roman Empire, and you couldn't possibly write about the Roman Empire without thinking about that. Full stop. That's what people really need to learn. And Kathleen, and here's where I get right in the middle of big debates, you can learn historical stuff from studying many different kinds of history, and you can learn how to think scientifically from studying many different kinds of sciences. So I don't actually care whether you study geology first or astronomy first or physics first. I don't actually care whether you study U.S. history or Wisconsin history or the history of Europe, because once you learn how to think historically, then you've got the rest of your life. Going back to that Kindle example, I'm about to go to the Mediterranean, so I typed in the words Greece, Turkey, and Cyprus, which are the three places I'm going to go to, and my little Kindle right away produced a bunch of books. And because I know how to read and because I know how to make sense of history, I'll be a little bit less of a nudnik when I get there than I would have if I hadn't. But think of what the cost would be if we decided everybody should learn Greek history. There'd then be 1,000 other places which we didn't know about.
I understand. So what are you reading?
Excuse me. I'm reading both a history of Cyprus, which talks about Cyprus as a country greatly in conflict. But I also have a book which you can actually get for 99 cents on Kindle, which tells you about the sites to see and a little bit about them. And I'm doing a similar thing. I read a lot of Orhan Pamuk for Turkey because he's a Nobel Prize winner who written both nonfiction and fiction. That I didn't need my Kindle for because he's a world figure and I'd heard about them. But that's, again, educating yourself. Nobody told me I have to read these things, but I would like to go there and be a little bit less of an ugly American than I would if I didn't know anything about those countries at all.
Yeah. Judith, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Mike from Milwaukee next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. I'd like to ask Professor Gardner if he could comment on motivation. I once took a course with the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Frank Farley. He's kind of a nationally known psychologist, too. He specializes in motivation and personality. This was some time ago, but he said he actually believed that schools should accommodate a student's motivational level. By that he meant that you know, different people, students included, have different levels of internal stimulation, and they orient themselves to the world in order to either raise their level of internal stimulation or to lower it. So a person or a student in a classroom whose internal level of stimulation is very low, he's going to operate and orient himself in the classroom in such a way that's going to raise his level of internal stimulation. And, of course, you know, that student is going to be somewhat chaotic and disruptive. And at the same time, we have students who have whose internal level of stimulation is so high that they want to shut down stimulation coming from the outside world and, you know, from a classroom so that, they don't add to it. And so he actually proposed that we should have schools that could accommodate a student's level of internal stimulation, that for the student who is very, very you know, whose internal stimulation is so low that he's, you know, running around the classroom trying to raise his level of internal stimulation, that classrooms should be set up to accommodate that person. For instance, that person would have to have a color monitor, a lot of vibrant colors in the classroom. But the student whose level of internal stimulation is already very high, then that person should have a black and white color monitor and some very bland colors.
Howard, what do you think?
Well, when I talk about personalized education, there's certainly no reason why it can't include things which we might say are more low-key for people whose, you know, level of motivation is not so eruptive or disruptive as you described, and things which are people who need more color and bells and whistles in order to succeed. But I actually don't think that gets to the heart of the matter. I think the heart of the matter is that different people have potential to become interested in different things. And to me, the single biggest challenge in education for most young people is to find something that they're very excited about. My colleague Marcela Suarez Orozco, all over the world, gives people a three-word sentence: "School is fill in the blank." And you can already guess what the way it's described all over the world. Boring. That's always the way it gets filled in. But just about everybody has the potential to get interested and excited about something, and maybe even not just once or twice, but enough to become interested in it, passionate about it, work in a disciplined way over the years. And that's the big challenge. And what I think is missing about in the Farley presentation, as you put it forth, is factoring at how different we are when there's something we're very interested in as opposed to when we're just going through the drill. I mean, I'll use an anecdote. I often have parents who say, "Oh, you know, my child has, you know, tremendous attentional disorders and you know, can't really stick to anything for any period of time." And I say, "Tell me a bit more about the kid." And, you know, the second or third sentence is, "Well, he spends hours playing video games." And I say, "Gee, that's funny. I thought you couldn't spend more than a few minutes in anything." And the parent says, "Gee, I never thought about that." Now, I'm not saying that we should all have a regimen of video games, but anybody who's seen a lot of kids, and I have four of my own and a grandchild, and I've seen hundreds of others over the years, knows that when a child gets interested in something, all the previous claims about motivation and maybe even about, you know, I guess, is it called the T factor? Is that Farley's term? That goes into the background. So maybe to be a bit Talmudic about it, I think this level of issue is necessary, but it's not sufficient. The big question really is the issue of, can you find something somebody really wants to explore and then take advantage of that?
Thanks, Mike, for the call. Here's an interesting email. Hi, from Chuck in Green Bay. Individually guided instruction was one of the waves in education in the 70s. Teachers manufactured packets so that kids could be self-paced yet still meet the curriculum. He taught a self-paced science class in the 7th and 8th grade, and he found that the more able students did just enough work to stay ahead of the minimum pace, they weren't motivated to educate themselves. The less able students needed his support to learn. Where did the individualized guided instruction go, and what's better about what you propose, Howard?
Well, that's a great question, because it ties together the previous question from Mike. And that is that you have to both individualize the you know, the pace, as the caller says, or the, sorry, the writer says, but also you have to take into account what's the particular pathway that's right for that child. And if you have self-paced on the same curriculum, you've only handled one facet there. Namely, there's one curriculum, and some kids can go more through it more quickly, and some kids can go through it taking more time. That's fine, but the individualized education that I'm talking about is there'd be multiple pathways, and part of the coaching or self-sorting dimension is you figure out which pathway is going to work best for you. And, of course, after you've had some experience, you're going to have a better sense than when you're first starting out. So it's that combination where I think the power lies. Nonetheless, you know, when Kathleen, when you were giving that wonderful but somewhat hyperbolic introduction, I said to myself, well, you know, schools are the most conservative institutions we know. And, you know, people who were in schools 100 years ago and came to see them today would still recognize many, many facets. And it's not – even if all the technology is there, it doesn't mean that teachers and principals and schools and test makers are necessarily going to embrace it. And that's why I'm very much with Clay Christensen. I think it's more in self-education and homeschooling and the kind of thing which we do as adults when we're no longer in school. Once we see how effective those things can be vis-a-vis standardized education, I described it, or standardized education with self-pacing, as the email writer described it, then there's going to be real tension. Do we stick with the standardized, or do we say those places that are standardized are just going to lose out totally to those places which are much more individualized, not only in terms of pacing, not only in terms of motivation, but in terms of the 27 ways in which you can learn Euclid,
right,
or Plato, or you know, playing backgammon, which apparently is more difficult for computers to play than chess. Don't ask me why.
Howard Gardner is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. He is professor of cognition and education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. But this guy's got a great mind. He was selected, and he's been recognized for having a great mind, selected by Foreign Policy and Prospect magazines as one of the 100 most influential public intellectuals in the world. He was asked by Foreign Policy, what's next? What's next big thing? Which is a fun question and an important question. And his answer, to be found in the May-June issue of Foreign Policy, is personalized education. More phone calls. We have a ton of them. And if you want to send an email, if you can't get through, we'll do a couple emails too. That's talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls for Howard Gardner, Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. I go back about 45 years. I attended a one-room country school for 8 years, and I also taught one in Nebraska for a few years. And those country schools were self-paced, because if you got 12 or 15 students, you only got one or two in each grade, and you can pace it at the individual needs. And they were just plain creative, because you could find projects that interested the kids, interested the students, and they would just literally take off on it. And when you got around to your Christmas program, you just kind of stood back and just kind of let them organize it, and they would just get plain creative with the pieces, the songs, and the plays, and everything else. The creativity that went into those was just fabulous. And what you also had, your three men, generally it was two men and a woman. Your woman, the lady on the board, would generally wind up being the treasurer. But you could change textbooks, and those students that were coming out of those country schools were generally way ahead of those coming out of the village system, because you were putting I taught in public schools too, but you're putting a blanket on all 15 or 20 students you've got in one grade, and you can't slow it down for two or three. But in those country schools, you could. And the creativity was just fabulous.
Howard.
It's good to hear that, and we should always be aware that there's so many ways to do things. One of the worst things about part of contemporary American society is we think we can't learn from other countries, whether it's education or health care or the interpretation of the Constitution. And it's very valuable to think about how education could have been done effectively at a very different time. I suspect there's one other factor there, and that is that the teachers really got to know the students and the students really got to know one another. And so there could be a lot more personalization because it's almost like a family when you're in the same school for many, many years. One of the problems nowadays is that people are so mobile that you have a situation where in a school, even if you had the same teachers for a few years, you might have different students. And when you have both different teachers, as is the norm now, and, you know, 20 or 30% of the students each year are different, and to add to the mix, they speak a bunch of different languages, it's very hard to create that kind of common implicit culture, which I think was present in Eugene's school 45 years ago and which he seems to have been able to recreate more recently.
Thank you, Eugene. Always a pleasure to hear from you. Let's go next to Sarah from Price County. Hello, Sarah.
Hello. Speaking of expatriated and mobile, I have a practical question in the sense that my children are in elementary school in the existing systems now. However, I'm looking for a program that would bring together multiple systems, including the overseas systems, different states, because we live overseas for 2 years at a time, different countries, and then different states in the United States when we're back. So is there anything that exists to personalize education to make that individualized system that a parent who's not terribly inclined to homeschool can administer?
Not to my knowledge, but as soon as you began to talk about being mobile, I right away thought about the International Baccalaureate, which is an organization that's existed now for decades. I'm quite involved with it, and it has a primary grades, a middle grades, and a secondary curriculum. It's respected all over the world. It's quite demanding. And schools connected with the IBO, as it's called, have an excellent reputation. If, in fact, you are mobile in that way, one way to provide continuity for your children would be to try to get them to go to international baccalaureate schools wherever they exist. And by now, by the way, now the largest number of international baccalaureate schools are in the United States. I always say that the more your situation is eccentric, or the more your kids are not just additional pea in the same pod, the more the reliability and the responsibility of education falls on your shoulders. So I think, Sarah, the fact that you're raising this question is a good one. And at least now in the days of the Internet, there are a lot more sites that you can go to try to get ideas. And even though you're not a homeschooler yourself, there are hundreds of homeschooling sites, and some of them might have some very valuable information for you to personalize, particularly if your kids don't happen to be that language logic blend, which is so easy as long as you're in school. Though once you start going to the rainforest, you discover they're quite different abilities that you need to survive.
Now, they do have the IBO option in some of the countries we live in, but then here in the United States, how do I continue that sort of liberal arts education that the IBO offers when that's not what the public schools offer?
Again, I don't have any magic formula for that. The more you know about the IB, and a lot of information about the IB is available either for free or at cost, the more you can do some of that yourself. The other thing, which is an interesting challenge for all of us in life, is if, in fact, you've been in international baccalaureate school, to what extent can the habits of mind and the habits of practice that you develop there be ones that you continue even after you leave school? Because, of course, all education is really about transfer. All of education says you're doing something from 9 to 3 now when you're 12 years old, in the hope that when you're twice as old and not in school, you'll be able to have some of the same habits of mind, some of the same discipline, and so on. So a wonderful challenge for you as a parent to say, well, you know, we were at this international baccalaureate school last year. We're not there this year. But what sorts of things that they highlighted there should we continue doing on our own? And so you can make a problem into a challenge. And if you get your kids on board, then it's a great learning experience for everybody.
It's interesting you hear about studying that way and living that way and think, don't you? I know my response was, oh, I wish I had grown up that way as a child, but I'm sure it's fraught with its difficulties as well. And she just outlined some of those.
But it's a very good preparation for the global world in which
yes,
we all live.
Right. And let's talk a little bit more about that global world. I know one of your projects, the Good Work Project, is developing good global citizens and students within their classrooms. What's new with that project? It's been around for a while now, Howard, hasn't it?
Yeah, for the last 15 years with colleagues in a number of different universities, we've been trying to understand what good work is and, as you said more recently, what good citizenship is. And the way we think about both of these spheres is as a combination of excellence engagement and ethics. A good worker is technically excellent. He or she has the discipline, knows what they're doing. They're personally engaged. This is the motivational question, which a number of the callers brought up, and carries things out in an ethical way. You can be quite skilled and quite engaged and yet try to cut every corner and try to avoid going to jail. That's not a good worker. That's a compromised worker. And interestingly, the same analysis applies to citizenship, whether you're talking about citizenship in Wisconsin or the country or the world. Excellent citizen knows the law, knows the regulations, knows the processes, cares, because if you know it but you don't vote, you don't speak up, you don't write letters, you don't go to meetings, then that knowledge is inert, and carries it out in a responsible way. You know, many people are citizens who are just trying to promote their own self-interest, get every goody they can, but the ethical citizen says not just what's right for me but what's right for the larger polity. And I have an analysis which is kind of made for the media, with due apologies. I think in the United States we've gone through a period of three M's: markets, money, and me. And very large parts of the society, and Wall Street kind of stands for that, have believed markets are the best entry to everything. Money is the way you should judge things, and in the end it's about me and how many goodies can I collect. The financial meltdown was a big wake-up call, and if you think about M as three M's, and you flip it 90 degrees, you get the three E's, which are excellence, engagement, and ethics. And if you flip the three E's another 90 degrees, you get a W for we. And when President Obama talked in the campaign, he said, it's not about me, it's about you. I didn't quite get it. But now, with some months, I do get it. And that is, no single person, no matter how charismatic, is going to flip those money market me stuff to excellence, engagement, and ethics. But if we as a society decide we want to be in a place where people know what they're doing, are engaged, and doing it in an ethical way, whether we're talking about the workplace or about the role of citizen, we can make it happen. And you know, this is one of those turning points in history where if we don't flip those three M's to some extent, if we stick to money, markets, and me being about everything, it's going to be disastrous for the country, and alas, it's going to be disastrous for the world, because we still are the linchpin for the globe, whether we like it or not. So to respond to what you said, Kathleen, we've been working on these things for 15 years. Suddenly they acquire a relevance which I think nobody had anticipated, and if in fact we can make our country and our world more incorporative, more about we, and more concerned about ethical issues as well as issues of engagement and excellence, then what looks like a tremendous turndown, disaster, might actually be a wake-up call to put us together in a better way. And again, quoting President Obama, you know, we don't want to be back to where we were. We want to be going to where we should be. And that may not be where we were, both in terms of huge amounts of money being made by people without their knowing what they were doing, and people on the other end of the economic spectrum, you know, accumulating both debts in their housing and debts in their credit cards, which they couldn't cover. We don't want to go back there. Certainly, I don't want to go back there. And I'm hoping that the good work, good citizenship image can provide another way of being. Not that markets are terrible, not that money is terrible, not even that me is terrible, but it's not the only thing. And the societies in the world which I admire the most, parts of Scandinavia, a wonderful community in Italy called Reggio Emilia, I think they've got the story better than we have over the last 10 or 15 years.
We have time for one more phone call, and it's Ron from Milwaukee. Hello, Ron.
Hi. What a wonderful conversation. I entered the special ed world 25 years ago when my son developed a cerebral palsy shortly after birth, and he's not very good verbally. But he's really good visually, I think. And yet our whole society and education system is based, it appears to me, on this verbal communication. Special ed and individual training, you know, individual instruction for children has been pushing. I always thought it would lead the education system with all of its discoveries. There's a program called PixWriter, which is pictures. You can write with pictures and form sentences. Well, it hasn't done that great for my son, but it is advanced technology. Can you speak to the visual development of communications? Because we know that the Internet, YouTube, and, I mean, kids and people are communicating visually probably a lot more effectively 1,000 words per picture. You know, a picture's worth 1,000 words. What?
We only have about 40 seconds left, Howard.
Okay, well, I think you're right on the money. Young people are way ahead of the rest of us on this. We have lots of evidence from our own work that they're extremely visually attuned, graphically attuned, and not just taking information in, but being able to create in the Web 2.2 model. There's a wonderful organization in Massachusetts called CAST, C-A-S-T. The email is cast.org. They no longer talk about students that are disabled. They talk about curriculum that are disabled, and many of them are very visually oriented. And if nobody takes anything else from this program except to learn about the work of CAST, I'll feel the time's been well spent.
Oh, they're taking a lot more than that from this program. Howard, I just love having you on the air. I just love listening to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thanks,
it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Howard Gardner, and if you want to find more about his books or what he's up to, and it's always something interesting, his website is Howard Gardner. That's altogether his name. You spell his last name, GARDNER.com. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this interesting hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.